This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, I'm Jan. I'm reading from the Chicago Tribune for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. Our first article, Chicago to have one unified system for homeless and migrants, city and state officials say, by Nell Salzman. The city and state are in the planning stages to combine Chicago's legacy homeless shelter system with its system for migrants, according to government officials, and turn it into a unified shelter structure, an idea advocates for the homeless have long championed. The One System initiative will shift a permanent shelter management to the nonprofit workforce, Illinois Department of Human Services spokesman Daisy Contreras said in a statement. Currently, the city contracts with Favorite Healthcare Staffing, whose sizable overtime has contributed to tens of millions of dollars in city payments to the firm staffing the city's migrant shelters. The state's Office to Prevent and End Homelessness will lead the initiative with more than 25 community-based agencies participating, Contreras said. Planning sessions are set to begin at the end of April and go through the spring. Beatriz Ponce de Leon, Chicago's deputy mayor of Immigrant, Migrant, and Refugee Rights, said officials ultimately hope to fully transition to a unified shelter system and look beyond shelter to affordable housing. The goal, she said, is to serve people regardless or if they've been here for 5 days or 5 years or their whole life. Homeless advocates say combining the shelter systems will take time and coordination, but will be beneficial. The two shelter systems, catering toward the homeless and migrant populations in Chicago, respectively, currently compete for limited affordable housing resources, said Nicole Bahena, Vice President of Community Partnerships for All Chicago, in a written statement to the Tribune. Consolidating will help reduce competition and reduce wasted time and effort, Bahena said. The city opened its first shelters catering to migrants in early September 2022, after Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott began sending migrants to Chicago and other sanctuary cities on buses and planes, in part to draw attention to strained resources in border cities. But Chicago's open-armed approach to welcoming migrants quickly crashed into the reality of limited resources and past disinvestment in city neighborhoods. The city and state are now housing 8,724 migrants in 17 buildings, according to the city data released Sunday. Nearly 40,000 migrants have passed through Chicago since Abbott's busing began, and more arrive each week. Bahena said the separate system that was set up for migrants is different from the one typically used in the homeless sector. Providers helping asylum seekers may be new to housing and homelessness. Combining these program models, she said, may pose challenges. This will require new staff positions, including system coordinators, translators, and other staff to support a coordinated system that must be adaptable as we learn, she said in the statement. Ponce de Leon said the plan is still in its infancy, but they hope to have a more public report at the end of the summer. She said the state's chief homelessness officer and the city's new homelessness officer are involved in the discussions. Sam Paler Ponce, Interim Associate Director of Policy for the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, said combining the systems is a move in the right direction. The biggest benefit, he said, is that asylum seekers will have a wider array of supportive services made available to them, employment, food, and health care. But combining the systems could also lead to an influx in shelter bed demand, he said. According to recent data from the organization, there are more than 68,000 people currently experiencing homelessness in Chicago. Nearly 37,000 people accessed homeless services throughout the year. These figures don't include migrants. As the city faces budget concerns and closes shelters, volunteers and migrant advocates expect an increase in street homelessness and people doubled up or sharing a house with others due to economic hardship or a similar reason. They say the solution is to provide wraparound services and affordable housing instead of increasing shelter capacity. Mayor Brandon Johnson has already closed more than 10 shelters from the height of shelter operations in mid-January. He has also imposed 60-day limits for migrants staying at shelters, with case-by-case exemptions for people with medical conditions, pregnant women, and families with children, among other qualifications. The number of evictions from shelters was slow when they began in mid-March, but has recently increased, with 51 people leaving the system on Saturday. A total of 270 individuals had exited the system as of Sunday, and that number will likely go up through the end of April. There are several key demographic differences between migrants staying in shelters and Chicagoans experiencing homelessness, said Jen Torres, a mutual aid volunteer who has helped migrants across the city. Torres said asylum seekers who have trekked for thousands of miles to make it to Chicago have distinct mental health needs, for instance, and there are far more families. The Chicago Public Schools system is federally required to support the enrollment and education of students who are homeless or in temporary living situations. This number has gone up substantially over the past year, providing a window into the number of migrant children relying on city services. There were 22,250 students in temporary living situations enrolled at the end of March, a 48% increase from last March, and more than ever recorded at this time of year, according to data provided by the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. Torres worries about the Chicago homeless shelter system's ability to provide for migrant needs. To make matters more difficult, most asylum seekers can't work legally. "We have a lackluster shelter system to begin with," she said, "but migrants can't pay rent, and they have children." She and other volunteers are already preparing for a time when, like last summer, migrants may be camped out in police station lobbies across the city. Our next article: groups battling opioid crisis express frustration over state's speed in distributing millions of dollars from legal settlements, by Olivia Olander. Legal settlements with prescription painkiller manufacturers, distributors, and sellers have put Illinois in line for some $1.3 billion in payouts intended to help in fighting an opioid crisis that's killing tens of thousands of Americans every year. The payouts stem from multi-state agreements with major drug distributors, manufacturers, and household names such as CVS, Walgreens, and Johnson & Johnson. Payments started in 2022 and will continue well into the next decade and offer the potential for a significant investment in harm reduction and treatment efforts. Nationwide, more than $50 billion is expected from the settlements, according to KFF Health News, which tracks the money. But so far, the flow of settlement money to organizations in Illinois has remained barely a trickle. A complex bureaucratic process for distributing the funds has put only a tiny fraction of the money into the hands of organizations dealing with the crisis. "I am concerned that it doesn't appear that significant funds have been dispersed up to this point," said Tanya Sorrell, director at the Rush Substance Use Disorder Center of Excellence and co-chair of the Illinois Harm Reduction and Recovery Coalition. Overall, Illinois has received more than $200 million from the largest national opioid settlement to date, according to the KFF Health News Tracker. The estimated future payout from that settlement is more than $572 million, according to KFF. Additional smaller settlements will bring in hundreds of millions more over almost two decades. The money from the settlements is split three ways. 55% goes to a so-called remediation fund, while the rest is divided between state administrative costs and local governments, according to an emailed statement from the Illinois Department of Human Services and the State Attorney General's Office. As of last week, about $103 million in the remediation fund had been approved for specific programs, but only about $5 million had been handed out. According to slides presented by State Opioid Settlement Administrator Jim Wilkerson at a public meeting, that has frustrated some advocates who say the speed at which the money is being doled out doesn't match the urgency of an issue that's still deadly for Illinoisans. More than 13,000 Illinois residents died from an opioid overdose between 2018 and 2022, according to the state. Additional funds may have been expended on the local level, but those payouts are not tracked publicly by the state. Settlements between pharmaceutical companies and states are in many ways similar to those from the big tobacco lawsuits of the 1990s. Unlike the tobacco settlement, though, there are a greater number of guardrails for Illinois and other states on how the money is spent. The tobacco settlement, in many cases, was used to shore up budgets overall rather than on anti-tobacco programs. Illinois, in 2000, used part of its share of the funds for hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks, some mailed directly to taxpayers shortly before the November 2000 election. The money in the Illinois Remediation Fund must be used for strategies to mitigate the crisis at hand, per the state's settlement allocation agreement. Other states have interpreted that directive broadly, from safer syringe programs to treatment centers to bolstering law enforcement. The pace of distributing money from the remediation fund soon should pick up after the first few notices of funding opportunities were released early this year, said Judd DeLoss, CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health and a member of the Illinois Opioid Remediation Advisory Board. The board, which has met since 2022 and consists of leaders both inside and outside government, makes recommendations on how the funds should be spent. It's aiming to average an annual spend of about $42 million, Wilkerson said in a public meeting last week. John Werning, executive director at the Harm Reduction Organization, Chicago Recovery Alliance, said his biggest concern is the government's inability to get the money quickly to those trying to mitigate deaths and overdoses on the ground. Even government moving swiftly is often slower than what the current crisis calls for, said Werning, whose group provides counseling, naloxone, and safer materials from mobile vans to people who use drugs. He is also a part of the State Advisory Board's Working Group on Access and Equity. Opinions differ on how the payouts should be prioritized, and DeLoss and Werning have already questioned how some of the funds had been allocated. DeLoss said he thinks the money should be most focused on community programs that can make a large, direct impact, and took issue with the early allocation of $3.75 million and nearly $1.7 million paid out into Illinois' prescription monitoring program. The program, an existing service overseen by the state, tracks dispensing data on certain drugs, including prescription opioids. It's kind of frustrating that some of these funds got out the door early to those kinds of recipients that really aren't deeply enmeshed in dealing with the crisis, and those that are dealing with it are trying to address extremely complicated requirements for funding opportunities that hamstring them, DeLoss said. It's clearly not a life-or-death situation to fund the prescription monitoring program, he said. The majority of the board, however, voted to support the funding of the program last year as part of the key strategy to prevent overprescribing opioids, a spokesperson for IDHS and the Attorney General's Office said in an email. The process for distributing money from the remediation fund to community organizations is complicated, involving dozens of people and a handful of entities meant to ensure the money is used responsibly. An explanation of the process provided in one advisory board Zoom meeting included 2 slides, 10 steps, and nearly a dozen acronyms. Strategy ideas initially go through the Office of State Opioid Settlement Administrator Wilkinson, then through the board tasked with making recommendations. Those recommendations are taken up by a steering committee led by Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, then reviewed by the Attorney General's Office. The Division of Illinois Department of Health Services, tasked with substance use, strategizes for the plan's implementation, then forwards it to yet another entity that handles the actual notice of funding opportunity and selection of grantees. Only at that point would groups doing the actual work to fight the epidemic actually see the money. All of the money so far has gone to programs previously funded by the state. Werning said organizations like his own that focus on harm reduction, seeking to reduce the physical and societal harms of opioids and keep users alive, as opposed to an abstinence-based approach, should be in line for more funding. And as the harm reduction philosophy becomes more mainstream, there's more groups in competition for funds set aside for the purpose, he said. Community leaders said they appreciate efforts by the state to make funding opportunities accessible to smaller organizations. And they stressed that they're ready with programs and ideas to help people with substance use disorder once the money comes in. We know what to do, said Melissa Hernandez, director of the Puerto Rico Project, a program specializing in outreach to people who are homeless. We just don't have enough people. Our next article. Attorneys grappled over 30-year-old evidence at close of unusual double murder trial by Megan Krepow. For years, Gerald Reed's claims of abuse by Chicago detectives were in the spotlight. All eyes were on his tangled case as the justice system once again had to grapple with a decades-old legacy of police torture. But last week, as Reed was finally brought to a retrial, the focus shifted in a crucial way. Entirely separate from his allegations of torture, is he actually guilty of a gruesome 1990 double murder? He is responsible, said Special Prosecutor Mary Jennings in closing arguments Thursday. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to say he is responsible. Reed's attorney, Elliot Zinger, in turn, called the evidence thin and speculative. You can't guess people into the penitentiary, he said in his closing. All week, Reed sat at the defense table with a look of keen attention. He rarely took his eyes off the attorneys as they argued or cross-examined, except to take energetic notes or pull a discreet puff off of an inhaler. The stakes for him are high, but not quite the same as those of a typical murder defendant. Cook County Circuit Judge Stephen Watkins, not a jury, has been tasked with deciding Reed's fate. He said Thursday he will announce his finding, guilty or not guilty, next month. Due to a strange and possibly unprecedented set of circumstances, though, the decision might have little in the way of practical consequences for Reed. If Watkins convicts him, he cannot go back to prison for the murders. But even if Watkins acquits him, he is heading back to prison regardless, since he is in the middle of a sentence for a robbery conviction out of Indiana. Pamela Powers and Willie Williams were killed in October of 1990. Powers, shot twice in the head, was found half naked and fighting for breath under a viaduct near Englewood's Kennedy King College. She was pronounced dead not long afterward. Williams was found fatally shot in Powers' ransacked apartment. No physical evidence ties Reed or his long-convicted co-defendant, David Turner, to the crime, and there are no eyewitnesses to the shootings themselves. Prosecutors could not use the confession that Reed has long alleged he only gave after a detective kicked him so hard it broke the metal rod implanted in his leg. But, prosecutors pointed out, in the hours before the shooting, witnesses saw Reed with a frightened-looking Powers, who was shoeless and jacketless on a chilly October night. The bullets that killed Powers and Williams were fired from the same gun that Turner and Reed had access to, and Turner was known to have handled it not long before the killings. Two people testified at Reed's first trial in 1993 that Reed told them he killed someone. A 2.5-hour time frame, 3-block radius, and the same gun. Judge, they did it, Special Prosecutor Robert Milan said Thursday in closing arguments. No one else brought Pamela Powers into the apartment. No one else coasted her into the bathroom. No one else bragged to two young men. Reed's attorneys slammed prosecutors' story as thoroughly speculative. It is a red flag, Zinger said, that prosecutors do not have a theory as to which man, Reed or Turner, actually pulled the trigger. All we have here is guesswork. Here is what they think happened, he said. How does the state know, realistically, that David didn't do this murder and Gerald was playing cards? It's just speculation, and speculation is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Trying a case with 3-decade-old evidence presents obvious challenges. One crucial witness is dead. Prosecutors noted that in her previous under oath testimony, the witness said Powers came into her apartment that night with Reed close behind her, and Reed pushed her into the washroom and asked, "Where is the expletive money?" Years later, defense attorneys said in court filings that witness told her children the testimony she had given was false. But since she is dead, that previous testimony was entered into the record at this year's trial. While Watkins had ruled that her daughter could testify about whether she saw police mistreat her mother, she was ultimately not called as a witness. Two witnesses who did testify both had, as one attorney called it, amnesia. Deshaun Jackson and William Turner had testified at Reed's original trial that Reed came up to them not long after the shooting and asked if they had heard about someone getting killed. When they said they hadn't, Reed responded by saying, "Anyway, I did it," and pulled up his shirt to reveal a gun, according to the prior testimony. They both later recanted that testimony, according to court filings. But on the witness stand Wednesday, Jackson said over and over that he didn't remember anything, not about his 1993 testimony, and not about the version of events in the affidavit he signed. "He has been clean and sober for nearly a decade," he testified, "but his time using cocaine and marijuana took a toll on his memory." "I don't remember nothing from the 90s," he said. "Too many drugs." But William Turner's recent time on the stand should be considered more credible, Zinger said in closing arguments, urging Watkins to take seriously Turner's claim that he and Jackson were coerced by a relative into giving a phony story. They both had amnesia, Zinger said. I think it's very clear William Turner told this court the truth. The central witness was Mia Grover, who testified Monday via a Zoom link due to her poor health. She described seeing Powers enter an apartment building, shoeless and jacketless and looking scared, with Reed following close behind her. Later, listening in at a closed apartment door, she said she heard Turner say, "We're not going to have this expletive bitch," and then later overheard Reed say he could get a car. David said he didn't need a car. He could drop this bitch behind Kennedy King, Grover testified. In closing arguments, Zinger said Grover followed the script well, but was ultimately not reliable. Zinger noted that according to a police document, Grover's previous statement to the detectives had some discrepancies with her current testimony. Perhaps most prominently, she told detectives, Turner told her, "That guy came over and got Powers. Whoever that guy was may well have done the shooting," Zinger said. And if Grover was so scared that night, as she had testified, she would have called the police, Zinger said. But ultimately, the time frame was so tight and the locations of the crime scenes so close together that Reed and Turner are the only logical suspects, Milan said in closing arguments. One of Powers' neighbors heard gunshots coming from Powers' apartment only about 15 minutes before witnesses saw Reed follow Powers up the staircase in a nearby apartment building, Milan pointed out. You would have to believe someone else went in to kill Willie Williams, and within a 15-minute period, someone handed Powers over to Reed, Milan said, as if there was some kind of chain of bad guys. But Zinger said most of the prosecution's case amounts to speculation. No fingerprints, no murder weapon, no gunshot residue, no nothing, he said in closing arguments. No eyewitnesses to either murder. Our next article, Johnson safety plan slow out of the gate, but mayor vows root causes approach will work, by Alice Yin. Inside the Garfield Park Fieldhouse's cavernous basement, Mayor Brandon Johnson and other city officials spoke bullishly about their mission to tackle Chicago's crime. Titled The People's Plan for Community Safety, the strategy outlined by the progressive mayor last Wednesday evening at a community working group event encompassed his signature mantra of investing in people rather than relying on traditional law enforcement. It is critical that we engage with the victims as well as the perpetrators of violence to reach true safety, Johnson said. As we prove the effectiveness of our plan, we will grow this work in phases and continue to roll out so that every community in Chicago is safe. A year after he took office, however, Johnson's plan is still in its early stages, and crime remains a stubborn scourge across the city. And his move away from investing in more policing to address the problem has further inflamed opponents who have long distrusted his approach. In the West Side Fieldhouse, the reality of Chicago's violent streets was reflected in participants' grim tone as they set about brainstorming how to make the mayor's plans reality. Stephen Robinson, executive director of Northwest Austin Council and a former professor at Daly College, recalled a drug dealer from nearby Hamlin Avenue who enrolled in one of his classes after getting released from federal prison. "That bright young man was getting an A in my class by midterm," Robinson said, "but then disappeared." Robinson thinks he went back behind bars. The People's Plan is aimed at reaching men just like Robinson's former student, adults of high promise, as Johnson's office likes to say. Its first step was picking 10 blocks in 4 neighborhoods on the south and west sides to flood with resources, everything from cleaning up vacant lots to partnering with anti-violence organizations to support troubled youth. The people that are most severely impacted by the cycle of harm and the places that have been historically disinvested in are well overdue for revitalization, Johnson said at a March event, unveiling the blocks that would get the extra attention. In total, the mayor's 2024 budget allocates $100 million toward anti-violence programs, a strategy his predecessor, Lori Lightfoot, first latched onto and that Johnson seeks to multiply. However, while Johnson blames violence on the lack of job opportunities, disengagement from school or access to alternate pathways to careers, disengagement from housing, the scarcity of law enforcement solutions in the People's Plan has angered critics like Alderman Anthony Napolitano, a former Chicago police officer who represents the far northwest side, 41st Ward, where many cops reside. The goal for this administration and current city council leadership is to find more than one way to defund the police. Their goal is to take more of the police budget and reallocate it to social workers and nonprofits, Napolitano told the Tribune about Johnson's People's Plan. Their goal is to fund more nonprofits, who in the end will help them come election time. But Garion Gatewood, Johnson's deputy mayor for community safety, said the administration is holding these nonprofits accountable for producing results. He said his team is in the midst of conducting an assessment of all community anti-violence organizations funded by the city and how effective they are, though he did not elaborate on the standards for success. We can do both. We can both address those root causes by providing support for folks and also hold people accountable, Gatewood said in a phone interview. We've consistently asked our police departments to do too much. There has not been an actual plan until now to help alleviate some of those pressures from law enforcement. So I think a big piece of that is shared accountability. The four neighborhoods and 10 city blocks that will see the first wave of investments under the People's Plan are Englewood, 59th to 63rd Streets, between Racine and Morgan, Garfield Boulevard to 59th, between Racine and Morgan, West Garfield Park, Madison to Lexington, between Kenton and Colmar, Adams to the Eisenhower, between Keeler and Pulaski, Jackson to Harrison, between Pulaski and Hamlin. In Austin, Madison to Adams, between Laramie and Laverne, West End to Madison, between Laramie and Laverne, and Little Village, 26th to 27th, between Kildare and Pulaski, 27th to 28th, between Kildare and Pulaski. Johnson's team chose the locations based on several metrics: number of shootings, past school closures, unemployment rates, health determinants, and other signs of disinvestment. In each of those four neighborhoods, a community organization will receive $250,000 to implement Johnson's goal of targeting people-based and place-based approaches to revitalization. Gregory Matthews, a community engagement manager with the Chicago Community Safety Coordination Center, stood with Johnson last month when he unveiled the areas to receive investment. As someone tasked with informing the administration on the needs of the Garfield Park community, Matthews said revitalization begins with speaking frankly to youth involved in gang or drug activity about a critical subject, money, or how they can change the bag. Meeting them with legitimate alternatives is a crucial pillar of the People's Plan, he said. These are not bad people. They're kids in a weird situation because they've been raised to glorify something that 90% of society thinks is atrocious, Matthews said. So how do you get their culture to change? Well, the one thing that we have in common with the conversation is money. While the Johnson administration is eager to invest in youth jobs and more, many of the most ambitious initiatives under the People's Plan have yet to debut, such as an expanded guaranteed basic income program or a citywide certification program to professionalize and educate victim advocates. The mayor's commitment to reopen the shuttered mental health clinics, starting with two sites this year, also remains in its planning stages. A report from the task force is expected in May. The Peace Book, an activist-backed proposal to prop up a structure of youth peacekeepers to mediate conflicts in violent neighborhoods, remains pending in City Council, but will pilot 100 such roles this year as part of the city's One Summer Chicago Youth Jobs Program, which Johnson has expanded this year by 4,000 jobs to a total of 28,000. The administration has also identified 275 unkempt vacant lots in the four neighborhoods chosen under the People's Plan and cleaned up 49 of them as of this month. The mayor has argued he is moving expediently to implement his vision and that his focus on engaging and investing in community groups is unprecedented. I know that there's an urgent moment now, but real talk, y'all, we're not having these conversations 4 years ago, Johnson said in March when asked about the pace. So I feel the energy of wanting more because I'm with it, but I also see the work that is following it. And it's following it, I believe, relatively quickly, considering it's been less than a year. Johnson took office last May as the city was winding down from a historic crime spike in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic and civil unrest over the Minneapolis police murder of George Floyd. In 2021, Chicago recorded 800 homicides, the highest since the mid-1990s. Since then, Chicago has seen modest improvements, ending last year with homicides down 13% from 2022. But robberies increased 23%, while car thefts spiked 37%, and overall crimes remained at a far higher level than pre-2020 levels. So far in 2024, homicides are down 9% compared to this point in time last year, while robbery statistics have not significantly shifted and motor vehicle thefts are down 25%. Southeast Side Alderman Peter Chico, on leave from his job as a Chicago police officer while he represents the 10th Ward in the City Council, is among those who don't think the pace is the problem, but rather the mayor's neglect of more traditional answers to crime. Chico agrees with Johnson that we can't arrest our way out of the issues we have. But until the surfeit of complaints from his ward over lagging 911 police response time improves, he said the law enforcement component must not be neglected. We can do both simultaneously, addressing the root causes of crime and still dealing with the response times on the street-level policing. We just have to do a better job of getting to these calls in a more timely manner, Chico said, citing constituent complaints about 911 response times. I don't think we're there. I think it's going to be a long time before we ever get there. That's why we have to invest and look at policing on the street. Johnson's previous interim CPD superintendent, Fred Waller, now a deputy director in the department, said at last week's People's Plan event that community organizations should be seen as first responders too. He said beginning last year, the department piloted a shooting notification partnership between police districts and nonprofit anti-violence groups in districts 3, 4, and 15. Around the end of last year, that expanded to districts 5, 9, and 10, and districts 11, 6, and 7 will be next. The connection between CVI, Community Violence Intervention, and CPD at one time was tenuous, Waller said. People have always been skeptical. I've always been a person who I kind of say what I'm feeling. I've never been a person that's going to pour syrup over expletive and tell you it's pancakes, right? So CPD, along with CVI, we're keeping our hard hats on. We've got a long way to go, but the success has been seen as proven. Johnson's continued use of Waller, a self-styled old-school veteran of CPD, in a way reflects the mayor's own evolution from once embracing the defund police movement in 2020 to becoming City Hall's chief executive, with control over the nation's second-largest police department. In other ways, the coalition Johnson has assembled harkens back to his original ethos of focusing on the root causes of crime. Matthews, the community engagement manager who stood with Johnson at his March news conference, told the Tribune he believes that the presence of police, the most powerful gang in the city, instills a lack of agency in Black youth when what they need is opportunity. We all know that law enforcement doesn't work. Law enforcement and more enforcement is like digging a hole in dirt, Matthews said. The more you dig, the more the dirt is going to fall back into the hole. Our next article. Biden is marking Earth Day by announcing $7 billion in federal solar power grants. President Joe Biden is marking Earth Day by announcing $7 billion in federal grants for residential solar projects, serving 900,000-plus households in low- and middle-income communities. He also plans to expand his New Deal-style American Climate Corps Green Jobs Training Program. The grants are being awarded by the Environmental Protection Agency, which unveiled the 60 recipients on Monday. The projects are expected to eventually reduce emissions by the equivalent of 30 million metric tons of carbon dioxide and save households $350 million annually, according to senior administration officials. Biden's latest environmental announcements come as he is working to energize young voters for his reelection campaign. Young people were a key part of a broad but potentially fragile coalition that helped him defeat then-President Donald Trump in 2020. Some have joined protests around the country of the administration's handling of Israel's war with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Senior administration officials said young Americans are keenly invested in the Biden climate agenda and want to actually help enact it. The Climate Corps initiative is a way for them to do that, the officials said. Solar is gaining traction as a key renewable energy source that could reduce the nation's reliance on fossil fuels, which emit planet-warming greenhouse gases. Not only is it clean, but solar energy can also boost the reliability of the electric grid. But solar energy can have high costs for initial installation, making it inaccessible for many Americans, and potentially meaning a mingling of environmental policy with election year politics. 49 of the new grants are state-level awards. 6 serve Native American tribes, and 5 are multi-state awards. They can be used for investments such as rooftop solar and community solar gardens. Biden is making the announcement at Northern Virginia's Prince William Forest Park, about 30 miles southwest of Washington. It was established in 1936 as a summer camp for underprivileged youth from Washington, part of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps, to help create jobs during the Great Depression. Biden used executive action last year to create the American Climate Corps, modeled on Roosevelt's New Deal. He is announcing Monday that nearly 2,000 core positions are being offered across 36 states, including jobs offered in partnership with the North American Building Trades Unions. Biden has often used Earth Day as a backdrop to further his administration's climate initiatives. Last year, he signed an executive order creating the White House Office of Environmental Justice, meant to help ensure that poverty, race, and ethnic status do not lead to worse exposure to pollution and environmental harm. He has tried to draw a contrast with GOP congressional leaders who have called for less regulation of oil production to lower energy prices. Biden officials counter that GOP policies benefit highly profitable oil companies and could ultimately undermine U.S. efforts to compete with the Chinese in the renewable energy sector. Biden will use his Virginia visit to discuss how a climate crisis fully manifest to the American people in communities all across the country is also an opportunity for us to come together, said White House National Climate Advisor Ali Zaidi. He said the program can unlock economic opportunity to create pathways to middle-class supporting careers, to save people money and improve their quality of life. The awards came from the Solar for All program, part of the $27 billion Green Bank created as part of a sweeping climate law passed in 2022. The bank is intended to reduce climate and air pollution and send money to neighborhoods most in need, especially disadvantaged and low-income communities disproportionately impacted by climate change. EPA Deputy Administrator Janet McCabe said she was looking forward to these funds getting out into the community, giving people skills, putting them to work in their local communities, and allowing people to save on their energy bills so that they can put those dollars to other needs. Among those receiving grants are state projects to provide solar-equipped roofs for homes, college residences and residential-serving community solar projects in West Virginia, a nonprofit operating Mississippi Solar Lease Program, and solar workforce training initiatives in South Carolina. The taxpayer-funded Green Bank has faced Republican opposition and concerns over accountability for how the money gets used. EPA previously disbursed the other $20 billion of the bank's funds to nonprofits and community development banks for clean energy projects, such as residential heat pumps, additional energy-efficient home improvements, and larger-scale projects like electric vehicle charging stations and community cooling centers. Our next article. With homelessness on the rise, the Supreme Court will weigh bans on sleeping outdoors. The Supreme Court will consider Monday whether banning homeless people from sleeping outside when shelter space is lacking amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The case is considered the most significant to come before the High Court in decades on homelessness, which is reaching record levels in the United States. In California and other Western states, courts have ruled that it's unconstitutional to fine and arrest people sleeping in homeless encampments if shelter space is lacking. A cross-section of Democratic and Republican officials contend that makes it difficult for them to manage encampments, which can have dangerous and unsanitary living conditions. But hundreds of advocacy groups argue that allowing cities to punish people who need a place to sleep will criminalize homelessness and ultimately make the crisis worse. The Justice Department has also weighed in. It argues people shouldn't be punished just for sleeping outside, but only if there's a determination they truly have nowhere else to go. The case comes from the rural Oregon town of Grants Pass, which started fining people $295 for sleeping outside to manage homeless encampments that sprung up in the city's public parks as the cost of housing escalated. The measure was largely struck down by the San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which also found in 2018 that such bans violated the Eighth Amendment by punishing people for something they don't have control over. The case comes after homelessness in the United States grew a dramatic 12% to its highest reported level as soaring rents and a decline in coronavirus pandemic assistance combined to put housing out of reach for more Americans, according to federal data. Our next article, Kroger and Albertsons propose selling off more Illinois stores in bid for merger approval. Under federal scrutiny over their plans to merge, supermarket chains Kroger and Albertsons said they will sell off about 20 more Illinois grocery stores than originally planned in an updated divestiture plan announced Monday. In September, the grocery company said they planned to sell off the Mariano's brand name and 14 Kroger-owned grocery stores in Illinois. At the time, a spokesperson for Kroger-owned Mariano's confirmed that at least some Mariano's stores would be sold. On Monday, the company said its Illinois divestitures would include a total of 35 Kroger and Albertsons-owned stores.